Hi everybody, today is Wednesday, March 12th, 2025, and our friend Alex Grainer is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Nima. Always good to join you.
Let's get started, Alex, with the meeting, the first round of meeting between the Trump administration and the Ukrainians in Saudi Arabia. Here is what Marco Rubio said right after this meeting.
Today we made an offer that the Ukrainians have accepted, which is to enter into a ceasefire and into immediate negotiations to end this conflict in a way that's enduring and sustainable and accounts for their interests, their security, their ability to prosper as a nation. We both want to thank the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, His Majesty, for hosting us, for making this possible. They've been instrumental in this process, and we're very grateful to them for hosting us here today. And you know, hopefully we'll take this offer now to the Russians. And we hope that they'll say yes, to peace. The ball's now in their court. And but again, the president's objective here is number one, above everything else, he wants the war to end. And I think today Ukraine has taken a concrete step in that regard. We hope the Russians will reciprocate.
Yeah, they're talking about a possible 30-day ceasefire. And what's so amazing about that Emmanuel Macron said, I would welcome that. And I'm so happy with this concept. Right now, he is reiterating what Marco Rubio said, that the ball is now in Russia's court. Here is what Vladimir Putin in June 2024 said about any sort of ceasefire with Russia.
Эти условия очень простые. Украинские войска должны быть полностью выведены из Донецкой, Луганской народных республик, Херсонской и Запорожской областей. Причем, обращаю внимание, именно со всей территории этих регионов, в пределах их административных границ, которые существовали на момент их вхождения в Украину. Как только в Киеве заявят о том, что готовы к такому решению и начнут реальный вывод войск из этих регионов, а также официально уведомят об отказе от планов вступления в НАТО, с нашей стороны незамедлительно, буквально в ту же минуту, последует приказ прекратить огонь и начать переговоры. Повторю, мы это сделаем незамедлительно. Естественно, одновременно гарантируем беспрепятственный и безопасный отвод украинских частей и соединений.
Yeah, simply says that Ukrainians should withdraw their troops from Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporozhye, and Kherson, the first condition, the two preconditions that he's talking about. And Ukrainians have to announce or renounce their joining NATO, and they don't want to join NATO. Officially, they have to declare that. These are two preconditions for Russia to immediately go after some sort of ceasefire with Ukrainians. Are we going to see that Russia is going to change its mind toward the ceasefire, or are we going to see the same sort of preconditions for the ceasefire?
No, I very much doubt that, Nima, because why should they? I mean, you know, they might want to get along with the Trump administration, but Russia went to war in Ukraine because it felt an existential threat. And the existential threat comes from Ukraine being used as the beachhead, as a proxy for Western powers to wage war against Russia. It's not even a question of whether they can defeat Russia militarily, but it's enough for them to destabilize it, to bring about some sort of a regime change, and to go from there back to the business of plundering Russian resources and ultimately partitioning Russia into, balkanizing it into a number of smaller units. So from Russia's point of view, its long-term objective is to remove the threat to itself. Giving the Ukrainians a month to regroup and rearm is contrary to this strategy. Russia would actually be giving him a gift to be able to better threaten Russia's security. So I very much doubt that they will agree with this, unless there's also a move to demilitarize Ukraine, to state explicitly that Ukraine will not enter NATO. And then, you know, there's probably going to be a requirement to enable Russia to prosecute and bring to justice the Nazi side of the Ukrainian political spectrum. So the conditions are going to be extremely tough. I very much doubt that Zelensky, while he's in power, will agree to this. And I also very much doubt that the United States is going to be fighting for Ukraine's side very strongly. The Americans have already made it explicit that they do not consider Zelensky a legitimate representative of Ukraine and that they are demanding new elections. Another thing that Zelensky will not accept. So we'll have to see. We'll have to see how the situation evolves. But what I think is very important and encouraging is that the Russians and the Americans are talking to each other. They will be making deals that have nothing to do with Ukraine, or at least, you know, where Ukraine is a far second consideration, and which will not amount to a Christmas list of fading European powers who wish to retain their relevance. They will be left by the wayside. And I think that this is already happening. So whatever Macron has to say about it, you know, that's his business. I don't think that's being taken very seriously.
What's so amazing that we don't know what are the main articles, what are the main objectives of this 30 days ceasefire on the part of the United States. They don't mention any detail, but do you think that Russia would, I don't know how they can understand this sort of move on the part of the Trump administration. Is that going to be, as you've mentioned, they're going to prepare, they're going to rearm, they're going to regroup, they're going to, because we had a drone attack, we had a on Russia before 2 days ago. And how can we put these two pictures together? Are they going to negotiate 30 days? It's going to, and we also heard about that they're talking about the attacks from the sea and from the air, is not on the ground. How is that? Is that going to be the case in your opinion?
Well, I find that it's all extremely problematic. You know, these drone attacks, they're primarily provocations. And I think that they are being conducted in cooperation with the British assets in Ukraine. They've already, you know, put it in their 100-year partnership agreement, military cooperation on drone technologies, et cetera, et cetera. What is the point of all this? You cannot change the course of war with drones. Maritime drones, airborne drones, whatever you have, you can harass, you can cause damage, you can provoke, but you cannot prevail militarily. So we see that Ukraine, probably egged on by the British, is continuing to attack and provoke and make it impossible. You know, politically, it's impossible for Putin, even if he wanted to take Zelensky's government as a legitimate counterpart, and to make any kind of a deal, let alone to give them a 30-day breather. And then, you know, there are other problematic aspects here that, you know, we've had also attacks on U.S. assets, Twitter, which Elon Musk said that the attacks have apparently originated from Ukraine. That's very interesting. You know, in the United States, their nuclear use doctrine says that United States might respond with nuclear weapons to threats that include cyber attacks. So cyber attacks are on the list of threats that might justify a nuclear response. So now, you know, Ukraine apparently, or hackers from Ukraine, whether they have a relationship with the government or not, are now attacking US, you know, Twitter. We shouldn't regard it as a private property of Elon Musk. Elon Musk is a frontman. Twitter is a strategic asset of the US government. So now Twitter is under attack. We had two of Elon Musk's rockets that, you know, that were being successfully launched and returned and launched and returned. Now suddenly two of them blow up. Then we had attacks on Tesla dealership and people destroying Tesla cars. It's getting very, very ugly. And then, you know, there's also a wider attack going on at the United States, because pretty much since Donald Trump's inauguration, we saw that the value of US dollar versus the euro and the pound went off a cliff. It fell by about, I think, 7 or 8%, which is very large in terms of foreign currency fluctuations. We've seen that the stock market has come down about 9%, and on, you know. So it seems to me that the Trump administration has taken the side against the empire. Not only is it withdrawing from being the empire's enforcement arm, but it seems to me that it's actually opposing the empire. Well, you know, the logic of the empire is you're with us, so you're against us. So if the United States is no longer with the empire, then they're against it. So, you know, the implication is that the Trump administration is now the enemy of the empire. And we see that rhetoric being gradually escalated. You know, we get statements from people like Chrystia Freeland. We had a really bizarre, really ugly article published in The Guardian by George Monbiot. And if you follow George Monbiot, you can kind of tell that he didn't write it. That was probably handed to him by the MI6. And it pretty much indicates the mindset. And the mindset is that the United States is now an enemy. So how do I, in that context, how do I read the statements about the ceasefire, about, you know, protecting Ukraine, Zelensky and his government? I kind of tend to regarded as a feeble and insincere attempt to placate Western public opinion. And that may sound harsh and radical, but I can't help thinking that, because things are getting real and they're getting ugly. And they're getting ugly at a level that where Ukraine is actually a sideshow. Even the Middle East is a sideshow. The main show is the conflict between the empire and the rest of humanity, the rest of the world. And it seems to me that Trump administration has taken sides. And we can even go back to Marco Rubio's statements that the post-World War II global order is now obsolete, that it is being used against the United States, that it has been weaponized against the United States. And again, you know, it wasn't Marco Rubio who thought up to say that. That's the position of the government of the United States at the moment. So I think we have to look at it, how it evolves. The Russians probably are going to say nyet, and the Americans are going to have to react in some way to this. And then we'll find out what happens. I very much doubt that they are taking a sincere stand that happens to favor Ukraine and France and Britain and NATO. I don't see it that way.
What's so amazing about the negotiations, the first round of negotiation, is that we don't see Keith Kellogg in the team. And we know that Donald Trump was talking, even after the meeting between Zelensky and Donald Trump, he said that Keith Kellogg is going to be in charge of talks with Russia. There is no Keith Kellogg there. That's why I'm so skeptical about what's going on there. They're talking about 30 days, which doesn't make sense. And how about if they talking, as Putin was pointing out in June 2024, they're trying to do whatever is in interest of the United States and Russia together, and they're not announcing it. They're just putting out something else. Is that a possibility to think of?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to suggest. I think that it's quite plausible that the whole act there is a head fake, but it's being used as a venue for the two delegations to meet together and to discuss much more significant issues. Keith Kellogg, I kind of expected that when Zelensky came to Saudi Arabia, that he would be meeting with Keith Kellogg. I was surprised that he met actually with Waltz and Rubio. But okay, so they gave him FaceTime with Marco Rubio and Waltz. Still, I think I expect that the outcome will not be what we are being led to believe at the moment, and that nothing will come of this 30-day ceasefire. And I think that Russians would be fully in the right to say, like, hey, we give them a 30-day breather, and they are launching drones on Moscow. The answer is yet, and the Americans will have to say, well, okay, well, let's see, how do we package this up for public relations purposes?
I think, Alex, right now, whenever I think of Ukraine, I remember Syria and the situation in Syria. We had a city in Syria called Idlib. Idlib was the main source of these people who captured the government in Syria right now, and they're ruling, they're governing Syria right now. It seems to me that in the mind of the West and the collective West or the establishment, they're thinking of Ukraine, the Western part of Ukraine, to be a new Idlib close to Russia. And they can destabilize, they can force Russia, they can, a lot of things they can do with Ukrainian ultra-nationalists. Is that of concern for Russia? Is that important for Russia to address the issue? That we had the same experience in Syria. How do you see the way that Russia sees the western part of Ukraine?
I think that's absolutely the case. You know, there's a massive problem because there's an overlap of populations. There's about 2 million Ukrainian refugees living in Russia today. And there's a lot of other Ukrainians who have, you know, migrated to Russia over the last few decades for reasons of work. They have families that are, you know, partly live in Ukraine, part of the family lives in Russia. They speak fluent Russian, they look like Russians, and they can move about. And, you know, in that population, there could be a small percentage of potential terrorist assassins, saboteurs, whatever. And then, you know, we also know from the this 100-year partnership agreement with the United Kingdom that they have, that the United Kingdom wants to control the ports on the Black Sea that belong to Ukraine. And that means that they would give themselves, you know, they would control the gates to Troy, you know, and they could slip in Trojan horses on a conveyor belt. And, you know, two very commonly used foreign policy tools that the British Empire has used for centuries have been terrorism and opium wars. So they could use Western Ukraine not only as a hub for cultivating insurgencies and terrorist organizations to use against Russia, but also to flood Russia with drugs, and to try to attack Russia with a 21st century version of opium war. And then let's not forget that they had and still have some of those bio labs in Ukraine, which they might use to attack Russia also with the biological weapons. So all of those things are very, very serious concerns for Russia, because, you know, the movement of Ukrainian people here and there, it's always going to be porous to some extent. You're never going to be able to have a hermetic border that nothing goes in and out. So I think that from Russia's point of view, it'll be very, very important to control the ports, to the Black Sea ports. And that means that Russians will have to insist on new elections in Ukraine, and they will seek to they will want the new government in Kiev to realign with Russia, and then they can take control of pretty much the rest of Ukraine, with the exception of maybe just the western enclave in around Lvov, administratively. So, you know, once you're in control of the government administration, then you can do a lot of things that you no longer have to do with military force, but to the same effect of securing your own neighborhood, your own backyard, so you're not open to various kinds of attacks and sabotage.
I would say, Alex, whenever they're talking about the security guarantee to Ukraine on the part of Europeans or on the part of the establishment in the United States, the best security guarantee would be a Ukrainian neutrality forever. And here, is that going to happen in the mindset of Europeans? Are they capable of, are they interested of having that as a policy?
Europeans are in a kind of demented, deranged search of their own identity. I don't think they know who they want to be or what they want to be. The current ruling establishments in most European governments are still completely attached to this Project Ukraine. They're devoted to it. They cannot see past it. And so they are reacting hysterically to the new developments, you know, that they no longer have unconditional support from the United States, that Ukraine is losing, that they don't have the troops or the weapons or the technology to do anything much about it. And so they're trying to make a lot of noise, to pretend, to announce all these big projects and 850 billion euros for rearmament, rearm Europe. You know, Ursula von der Leyen hasn't taken on a project in her career that I know of that she hasn't bungled completely. So, you know, in all likelihood, she will bungle this one as well. So I very much doubt that the Europeans are going to be able to mount anything halfway effective to counter the developments that they want to counter. But at the same time, you know, we have to keep in mind that there's also a bottom-up movement in Europe among the people who don't want to have anything to do with these wars and who are entirely sick and tired of the EU as it is today. And so we see what's happening, you know, the elections in France, the elections in Germany, the elections in Romania, Hungary, Croatia, Slovakia, and so forth. And the tide of public opinion is turning sharply against the current ruling establishment in the EU, which means that they have limited time. So what, you know, when we speak about European, I think that we're talking about the Europeans who are in charge of governing the EU today. But I think that with time, that's all going to have to change, or else the EU is going to simply disintegrate. And the countries, individual countries, are going to simply what they call in business, quiet resignations. You know, when you remain a member of something, you remain an employee in a company, but you're just doing the very minimum and you're not turning up to work and everything that they expect you to do, you just kind of ignore. And so it's going to be slow erosion over time until some countries say, and until the EU has its Belavezha agreements, accords moment, you know, when the Soviet Union was disintegrating, then there was this Belavezha Accords in 1991, which were where, you know, the apparatchiks got together and said, like, okay, this is not working. Let's just call it quits and declare that Soviet Union is no longer. I think that the European Union is moving in that direction. And I think it's only a matter of time, unless there's a willingness to reform, which there absolutely isn't. The current model of governance is so entrenched and so defensive that I think it's almost unthinkable that they will allow any kind of meaningful democratic reform to the European Union. I mean, we see what they're doing in Romania. That's appalling, and it's making the EU look like a bad version of the USSR, like a fascist version of USSR.
Alex, what's at stake for them in Romania that they're insisting they just remove the candidate Georgescu, and they don't let him to run? And it's so amazing to me that they want to ignore the right of people to vote for him. And what's the importance of that? Because it seems that the whole European, I don't know, gang is behind this. The whole European establishment is behind this policy in Romania. What's stake for them in Romania?
Well, it seems to me that they have designated Romania as the next bludgeon to use against Russia. You know, Romania and Moldova. I don't think they have any delusions that could turn around that they would be able to defeat Russia militarily in this way. But, you know, controlling the ports in the Black Sea, Constanta and so forth, and then keeping the Romanian government loyal to the Project Ukraine, that's what's at stake. But I also think that it's a question of precedent. So if they allow this to happen in Romania, and then, you know, like if you had Georgescu in Romania and he started to play a similar role in, like, Orban in Hungary, then, you know, there's always this this fear of the quote unquote domino effect, that the discord among European nations might escalate, and that they might lose control of how they want to shape the future of the European Union. And so I think that they have decided to go for broke to make sure that you can only have democracy if you vote the right way. If you vote the wrong way, well, then your vote doesn't count, and that's that. And everybody's going to have to toe the line. And, you know, whatever Brussels says, that's how it's going to be done. Democratic process in individual member nations is just going to be a fig leaf to pretend that these governments have legitimacy. I think it won't end well. I think that the tide has turned. I think that it's very difficult to reverse these tides. And I think that the only way you can do it is with harsher and harsher repression. And then the whole facade of liberal democracies and rule for the people and by the people is now proven beyond any doubt that it's false, that it's fake, that it's a phony, and that as a result, your people in Europe are losing faith in the whole project, which is going to then, you know, continue the cycle of more and more populist governments gaining more and more support forcing more and more repressive measures on the side of the Brussels unelected bureaucracy until the whole process just implodes, hopefully not in civil wars, hopefully not in that way, but you know, time will tell.
Yeah, after the talks between the United States and Ukrainians in Saudi Arabia, they have announced that they're gonna restore the aid to Ukraine. But they didn't mention, what does that mean? Is that gonna be intelligence, weapon? What, they're gonna send money to Ukraine? Here is the question and the main doubt about the way that Ukrainians were able to attack Russia by drones, which it seems that was failed. It was a failure, this attack. Do you think that the British government was behind the providing intelligence to Ukrainians to attack Russia, or they can get it from the United States or give it to Ukraine? What do we know about the intelligence of, I don't know, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom together? Because we can say that Donald Trump is distancing himself from the conflict in Ukraine. On the other hand, we know that they can, the British government together with Germany and France, they can play their role in terms of providing Ukraine with intelligence in order to attack Russia, which, by the way, by far was the most important move on the part of Europeans.
I don't know. Look, I don't have information about this, and I don't know that information about this would be given around. This would be secret. But those would be my suspicions. What you outline would be my suspicion. When the Trump administration stopped providing intelligence to the Ukrainians, they also asked the European governments to do the same, not to forward American intelligence to the Ukrainians. Now, can they get around this? Would they dare disobey what the Americans are asking of them? Would there be ways of providing that intelligence somehow covertly, you know, smuggle it through in some way? I think that's plausible. I think that's entirely a possibility. And I think that my suspicion would always be with those who are most zealously devoted to this Project Ukraine. And that, you know, that suspicion always falls on London first, and then Paris second. But apart from governments, you know, from central governments in every country, you know, you also have the intelligence network that are intertwined and connected in ways that we don't exactly know, but we know that German intelligence is working very closely with the British intelligence, with the Mossad, I think, and the CIA, and all of those structures that work covertly, that don't necessarily follow the orders of their legitimate government structures, they are the drivers of this Project Ukraine, and they will continue to wish, they will continue to try to reach their objectives, and their objective is to destabilize, weaken Russia, and to try in one way or another to engineer a regime change so that they could install in Vladimir Putin's place somebody like Boris Yeltsin, somebody that, you know, pushing a Trojan horse through the gates somehow. And the longer the thing goes on, the more they can cause drone attacks, terror attacks, any kind of way to try to destabilize the government, the more they will push on this, because I don't think they have anything else short of using nuclear weapons. I don't think they have anything else. They're being defeated strategically.
You've mentioned that the bigger picture is much more different from what we're witnessing in Ukraine and in the Middle East. Do you, in your opinion, what are the main obstacles of the Trump administration, the main barriers that Trump administration is facing in order to focus on the bigger picture?
I think it's the legacy policy over the last decades since the end of World War II, by which I mean that there is still a deeply rooted attachment to regard the European nations as quote unquote our allies. And so you have a lot of people, even let's say well-intentioned, well-informed people who are now saying, oh, but can we abandon our allies just like that? You know, as though we have to remain, you know, the United States has to remain loyal to them till the end of time, because for some reason, you know, we are these, we have these unbreakable alliances, and that we have to honor those bonds for all eternity, regardless of what it costs and what benefit it gives to the United States. So that's a problem. Another problem is that part of all that is obviously also the state of Israel. And the United States has a very, very deep attachment to the state of Israel, which reaches, you know, to the levels of cultural in the United States. So Donald Trump has two large, powerful voting blocks, which are the Jewish and Christian Zionists, the Christian evangelicals, who are passionately devoted to Israel, come what may, for weird reasons, but that's a fact, and that's how they see it. They don't necessarily see Israel as the empire's unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Middle East, which is what it was made for, which what it was created for. They see it as the, you know, a secure homeland for the long-suffering Jewish people, and as a some kind of a way to end times prophecies, where, you know, they expect the second coming of Christ, and then there has to, you know, it's strange. It's not. It's. I think it's twisted in a way, because Christian evangelicals don't look at Jews as sovereign people. They look at them as people who are going to be, you know, either have to convert to Christianity or perish. So that's kind of a perverted way, or perverted reason, to be supportive of Israel. But it is what it is, you know. That's how it's been kind of infused into the culture of the United States, and that's what Donald Trump and his administration are now dealing with. At the same time, the reality of geopolitical strategies, of geopolitical alignments, is that Israel was created as a beachhead to control the Middle East and the flow of resources from the Middle East. It's been used consistently to destabilize the region, to keep all the regional powers there weak and always at risk of destabilization. And so now, you know, I think it is the time is coming to reassess this. And it seems to me that this is clear to a part of Trump's administration, to the people around him. And it's not a weird thing, you know. Henry Kissinger predicted in 2012 that Israel would cease to exist within 10 years' time. That time has passed, but anyway, you know, if you're aware of the conditions and circumstances in the region, then you realize that this particular beachhead in its current form is unsustainable. So what do you do if you're squeezed between that powerful domestic voting bloc you have, and you can't afford to turn them into your enemies, and the geopolitical realities where you are, you know, maybe ready to flush this one down the toilet? I think you try to wait it out, and you try to give Netanyahu and his government enough rope so that they can hang themselves with it. And I suspect that this is what Trump is actually doing.
Do you see that the Trump administration sees Europe as a part of a solution to focus on the bigger picture, or they're going to be part of the problem?
When you say Europe, do you mean European Union, or do you mean
European Union? I'm talking about the European Union.
It's very clear that they are ignoring the European Union, that they regard it as part of the problem, no part of the solution. Ursula von der Leyen has been trying repeatedly to get in touch with Donald Trump by telephone. He's not taking her calls. And we saw what happened to Kaya Kallas, the High Commissioner for Foreign Affairs of the European Union. She flew over to Washington. She thought she was going to have a meeting with the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. And then Marco Rubio remembered that he had a hair appointment that day and canceled her meeting at the last moment. Now, I don't know if it was for a hair appointment, but it was obviously a kind of humiliation and a signal that we don't take you as our legitimate counterparts. We will talk to the Germans, we will talk to the French, we'll talk to the British, and so on. We have nothing to discuss with the representatives of the European Union. Thank you and goodbye. So I think that's going to remain a fact. And now it's clear that, they will try to cultivate relationships with individual governments of different nations of Europe, and that in doing so they favor certain political factions. In Germany they favor AfD. They have been explicit about this. In Romania, they seem to favor Carlin Georgescu. They quite like Viktor Orban in Hungary. Emmanuel Macron, not so much. Keir Starmer, not so much either. So we'll see, but it's going to be interesting. I think that there's going to be very, very radical changes in the European, on the old continent. There's going to be realignment of forces. And I think that at this time, this is not yet all discernible. But it's clear that the governments of the main powers in Europe are now standing on very, very wobbly grounds, and I don't think that we have long-term stability to be able to predict how the developments will unfold exactly.
Do you find it too difficult for the elites in the United Kingdom to get aligned with the Trump administration, because they have a lot of ties with the establishment in the United States? We know that they're not in that much in favor of the Trump administration.
Yeah, I think it's going to be next to impossible for them to realign with Donald Trump administration. My observations led me to the conclusion that the way British ruling establishment regards their quote-unquote special relationship with the United States is what Churchill formulated as American brawn for the British brains, meaning America is the economic, military, political, diplomatic muscle that we control in pursuit of our agenda. And we hide behind that because, they always try to give the impression that out of sheer sense of loyalty, they've been following the United States through all these decades of imperial misadventures. And then when it goes sour, then they say, oh, these Americans, look at what they've done. And, we were just being loyal, a loyal ally. So we went along with it. But, we wouldn't have done it this way. We are much more decent and democratic than that. And so if that were true, then today, the British and the other Europeans as well would have to breathe a sigh of relief to say, like, oh God, finally this boondoggle in Ukraine is over. We can go back to, peaceful cooperation among nations, and we can call an end to this horrible conflict. They didn't react this way. They went hysterical, and they are now trying to regroup somehow to continue the same war without the United States, if the United States will withdraw their support. So now we realize who's the instigator of all this conflict. They were just using the United States as a proxy. They've been building those relationships for over a century, since the early 1900s. They've been consistently infiltrating the structures of power and the intelligence networks within the United States so that they would be able to control the U.S. politics, military, and the way the United States spends their foreign aid. And now I think this is coming to an end. That's how they experience and regard the United States, not as a friend and ally and a trading partner. That's all very secondary. They are still in pursuit of their global empire, and the United States is the main power that can make that possible. So I think that you and I have already talked in the past before Trump came to power, that the Western empire without the United States pretty much disintegrates into nothing. It's Britain, Canada, maybe Australia, Japan a little bit, some European powers on and off opportunistically, but it becomes, loses its main foundation. It loses its main, the glue that holds it all together. And so this is where we are now. And for them, you know, if we talk specifically about the British, going back to being a sovereign, neutral island nation is not even on the cards. They have no intention of doing this. They will do absolutely everything to try to revive and preserve whatever is left of their empire or commonwealth or whatever we wish to call it. And I think that two big parts of that strategy is to try to destroy Russia and to try to lasso United States back into line so that they continue supporting all these imperial projects.
Whenever it comes to those negotiations in Istanbul in the late March, early April 2022, before Russia decides that they're going to go in and fight the collective West in Ukraine. We had Boris Johnson going to Ukraine and talking with Zelensky and convincing him not to negotiate with Russia and go after some sort of war with Russia. I was asking myself that why they have decided to choose Boris Johnson. Why not Olaf Scholz? Why not Emmanuel Macron? And here comes the question. What is the main tie, the main connection between Zelensky as a person and the British government? What did they need to send Boris Johnson to convince him? And here is the main issue, I think, for the Trump administration, both for Trump and Putin. Zelensky is so much connected with the British intelligence and the British government. If they want to do something important, something substantial in Ukraine, there has to be a new presidential election in Ukraine. How do you see the way that I'm skeptical about the situation? And how do you see the way that the British government is connected to Zelensky as a person? I'm not talking about the president of Ukraine.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, we have, obviously, you know, this is not being spelled out for us explicitly. Nobody will come out and say, Zelensky is our agent and he's doing what we tell him to do. So, you know, we are where the buck stops. That's obviously not the case. But if we look at the pattern of events over many years, we see that, so Zelensky was brought to power by these certain oligarchs in Ukraine, some of them with dual citizenship in Israel. We saw that in 2020, Zelensky went to London, I think that was in October, and he spent, I think, 2 or 3 hours in a meeting with Sir Richard Moore, who is the head of MI6, at the headquarters of MI6, which is very highly unusual because Zelensky was already president of Ukraine at this point. And, you know, if a state head of state visits another country, he's going to meet with his counterpart. He's not going to go to their intelligence agency and sit there for 2 or 3 hours to be briefed about, I don't know what, you know, we don't know what they discussed, but There's a suspicion that he was briefed about the strategy going forward, which is, you know, provoke Russia into a major conflict and then become part of NATO. And then, you know, we also had a very strange meeting where Zelensky went to visit the Pope, and, you know, the protocol in a strange way went as the protocol goes. But beyond that, those brief encounters, Zelensky again spent about 90 minutes speaking to the Pope's, you know, foreign minister. I don't know exactly what the office is called, who is a British bishop. There's a suspicion that he's part of the British intelligence. And also allegedly, Sir Richard Moore was present at that meeting as well. And then you rightly point out that when the peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine were sabotaged by Boris Johnson, for some reason everybody said, like, the Americans said sent Boris Johnson there. And I always thought, like, why would the Americans send Boris Johnson of all people? Because they have an embassy in Kiev. They had Antony Blinken, foreign state secretary, who might have done that. They could have sent Victoria Nuland, who would have loved to do that. There's a whole number of people who could have. Kiev is crawling with CIA assets there. No, Boris Johnson of all people was sent. I think it's not the Americans who sent him. I think it's London, the city of London, who sent him. Boris Johnson is one of the centerpiece. He's the fixer for the British establishment. He was in Kiev on 24th February 2025, this year, so 3 weeks ago. And he was there to persuade Zelensky to reverse his rejection of the US rare earth deal. And I think that he also put pressure he caused pressure to be put on Ukraine's parliament to reverse their vote to decline extending Zelensky's presidential mandate, because his presidential term expired last May. And the first time the parliament voted on it, they said, no, it can't be extended because it would be unconstitutional. And then the day Boris Johnson comes to Kiev, they vote the second time, and this time they vote the resolution to extend his presidential mandate. Why was this important? It was important because Zelensky signed that 100-year partnership with the UK. And if he's not legitimate president of the country, then that partnership is null and void, potentially. So it seems that Boris Johnson does a whole lot of work for the British foreign policy establishment, even though he doesn't hold a government office at the time. So that's all very suspicious, and it suggests very strongly that this is some kind of, let's say, secret government business, not the business of the legitimate, let's pretend, democratically elected government in London, but some kind of a secret cabal that has its, you know, foreign policy agenda, and Boris Johnson is a fixer for them.
With the situation in Romania, I would argue that they would do everything to re-elect Zelensky in Ukraine. And the British government, and together with Emmanuel Macron and Olaf Scholz, and all these three countries are so important in terms of what's going on in Romania. You have to consider that. Is that gonna be problematic for Trump?
Well, it is all problematic for Trump, you know, because all of these current, let's say, government loyal to Brussels and to London are now taking an antagonistic stance towards the government in Washington. And so, you know, they don't have friendly counterparts to talk to. And, you know, that's part of the reason why Trump administration would prefer to have an AfD government in Germany, why they would prefer to have Carlin Georgescu in Romania. And they kind of have to put up with Keir Starmer in London and with Emmanuel Macron in Paris. But they would probably find it easier to deal with let's say, sovereigntist governments. And I think the result of, and then not to mention Turkey, Turkey is not part of the EU, but it is the strongest, second strongest military in NATO. The relationships between the United States and Turkey have gone, quite hostile in the last few years. And now they're probably the worst that they have been in the post-World War II era. And they share the quagmire in Syria, which is going to additionally complicate matter, and also the still opposite stance on Israel. Anyway, the result of all this, the ultimate result of all this, is that the most natural and logical counterpart and partner for the United States is in Moscow. It's Vladimir Putin. And we see that the events are slowly converging in that direction. And I was also, I have to say, I was quite encouraged a few days ago. Donald Trump had one of his sit-down press conferences, and I overheard the question, but it was something to do with China. And Trump, in his way, he was like, no, I have a great relationship with them. We have a really good relationship. And then he said, well, you don't hear me talk about China virus anymore, do you? And then he said again, I have a great relationship with Xi, and I talked to him. And then almost as an afterthought, he added, I speak with him a lot. I thought that was amazing. You know, that was quite huge to my mind. And I think it means that the United States, behind the facade that has to be maintained for domestic political purposes, I think that behind that facade, new relationships are being forged and cultivated between the United States, Russia, and China. And that's, at the same time when Marco Rubio was talking about the post-World War II order being obsolete, he also said that we have to accept the reality that we're living in a multipolar world. And I think that this is in reality what the Trump administration is now embracing. They're beginning to work in that sense with the Russians and with the Chinese. I think a big test is going to be Iran, but we already saw that Trump is not exactly taking a hostile approach to Iran. The Iranians are very right to be skeptical and to be, to demand respectful treatment. But it seems to me that the signals for Trump administration is that they want to cut a deal with Iran. They want the problem to go away. They want to have good relations. And they're going in that direction. And then, I have to, this is not necessarily related, but it is indicative that the mindset of the administration is different from what they try to project. And that is that Trump got caught talking to Hamas. Isn't that interesting? So we'll see. I don't know what the import of that, what the relevance of that will be, because I get the impression that there's two different Hamases, the Hamas that's on the ground in Gaza, and then the Hamas that's being coddled by Western intelligence in Qatar. And I don't see that they're necessarily the same organization with the same objectives and the same loyalties. But if Trump is talking to them, that's a good sign. You need to talk to people to try to make peace. And so I am encouraged and optimistic about how things are going. I'm in fact, I think that Trump has exceeded my optimistic expectation. And I know that many people think like, oh, you're so deluded, you're a dupe, you're naive. But the very fact that Donald Trump picked up the phone and called Vladimir Putin and spent 90 minutes talking to him respectfully and cordially is something that should qualify him for a Nobel Peace Prize. Because that bilateral relationship between Russia and the United States is far and away the most important relationship for the future of peace in this world. So the very fact that he picked up a phone and talked to the man and then nominated a delegation to continue talks and negotiations should give him a huge credit from anybody who's rightfully skeptical about, you know, what the administration is actually up to. That's a very good sign, and I think we need to support that.
I would argue not only peace, but the outcome of the peace would be a prosperous future for the nation.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. You're right. You're right about that. I agree.
Yeah. Alex, in terms of the way that Donald Trump is negotiating with Hamas in order to negotiate on the American hostages, American prisoners, do you think that Trump is going to just release American hostages and say to Netanyahu, so go ahead and find your sort of solution? I don't know what would that mean for Netanyahu. But I would argue with the way that Donald Trump is fighting Canada and Mexico, which are the two important countries on their border, which share a lot of economic ties with the United States. And I don't see he's willing to support the endless war of Netanyahu in the Middle East.
Well, you know, he clearly isn't supporting them. You know, he forced Netanyahu to stop bombing Gaza before he was even inaugurated. However he did it, that's the effect of it. I have a question for you because I got a lot of contrary information about this, but there was, Netanyahu was going to stop the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. And then apparently he got his chain yanked again by the administration and he had to reverse that. And then, you know, the information was that the humanitarian aid is still going into Gaza. But then I also received information from others that, no, it isn't actually. It stopped going. Do you know
It stopped going.
Oh, it did stop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it did stop. But partially, they're sending partially some sort of aid, but it's not at all that what it was before.
Yeah, but do we know if is it half? Is it one-tenth? Do we know that?
Is it I don't know. Just, no, nothing know considering that. Yeah, they don't mention that. Yeah. But mostly...
Regardless, you know, I think that Trump has done a few good things, which are very, very, very significant. The hostilities have stopped. The bombs have stopped dropping on the people of Palestine. He has forced Israel, I don't know how they did this, but he has forced Israel to vote in favor of the American resolution on Ukraine in the United Nations. To me, that was quite a staggering thing because Israel has been quietly supportive of Ukraine. Well, quietly, you know, not even so quietly. And the fact that they voted against the resolution to declare Russia aggressor in the United Nations, to me, was again an indicator that Donald Trump is not playing around and that he's forcing Netanyahu to toe his line. Obviously, he has to balance how he treats Netanyahu and Israel with his domestic voting public. But I have the impression, as I said before, that he's just kind of waiting it out because Netanyahu's days are numbered. He's really standing on thin ice. And then if Netanyahu falls, God only knows what happens from there, but it will get interesting to be sure.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today. Great.
Thank you, Nima. Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me and greetings to your audience.
Take care, Alex.
Take care. Bye-bye.